In 1978, Hollywood made a film about my life. It was called Midnight Express, and it told the story of my imprisonment and escape from a prison in Istanbul. The story itself was based upon the book I had written. At the time, I could only say certain things for legal reasons. The movie itself changed even the book to a point where not all of it is valid and true to my story. Now I have a chance to tell my story.
From Wondery, this is Locked Up Abroad. I'm your host, Jim Clementi. Our first episode, Midnight Express, tells the story of the arrest of Billy Hayes in 1970 and his imprisonment for possession of hashish at the Turkish airport. Most of us know about his harrowing experience and amazing escape to safety in Greece from the 1978 Oliver Stone film starring Brad Davis. But as we hear from Billy himself, that was the movie version. Now we hear the real story. In his own words, he tells us about his carefree post-college days, his reckless hubris, traveling to Turkey three times to smuggle drugs back to the United States for the easy money that he used to fuel his high-flying lifestyle. He was no innocent first-timer, as the movie suggests, but he definitely paid the price. How did youthful arrogance play a part in tempting fate, going back again and again into the belly of the beast? How did he survive through five horrifying years, and how has he recovered? And what scars persist in his memories about the pain that he caused his family? Midnight Express takes us on that journey, through the lows and the highs. This is not a Hollywood movie. This was his life. In his own words, this is Billy Hayes.
The first time I smoked marijuana, everything about my body said, "Ooh, that's good. I like that." To those who hadn't lived through the 60s, I pity you. It was just free love, which was a wonderful concept, and I fully took advantage of it. Patrick was one of my best friends in the 60s. He was a writer and a dreamer, and we instantly hit it off. I mean, the two of us saw the world in the same light. He was the guy that we would send out to pick up girls. He was so smooth, women just fell all over him. We'd like put him on a leash, send him off to a crowd of women, and he'd tackle two or three of them and bring them back to us. Great guy to have. I almost finished college when I had just enough, and I needed to get out and explore the world so I can experience life, so I can write about it. I needed money, so for about 2 months, I got a job at the Milwaukee County Hospital. One day while I was walking around, I walked past a room where somebody had a broken leg. Back then, they had like rolls of tape, and they dip them in water, and then wrap it, and then the cast hardens. And I thought, wow, that's easy. I could do that myself. And somewhere or other, that stuck in my mind, which stayed there until my friend who had been traveling came back from Istanbul, who had brought several little plaques of hash with him in his money belt. Most of the grass in the United States was not very good, and this was terrific hash. He told me that in Istanbul, they sell it on the streets, and it's, you know, very cheap. In those days, nobody searched you getting on an airplane. You could put a chicken under your arm and get on the plane. Nobody would know. So that idea was in this part of my brain. And having seen this cast was in the other side of my brain. And they came together, and I thought, you know what? I could do that. Making the money wasn't my goal. I wanted the adventure of doing it, and I wanted to pull it off. So I decided to go to Istanbul and smuggle some hash back. Literally, when I flew in, I was kind of looking at the different taxi drivers, and I saw this kind of semi-young, hippie-looking taxi cab driver kid. I said, I need to get to Sultanahmet.
Sultanahmet.
The hippie Sultanahmet. Neighborhood, as it were. And he said, hashish? I said, yeah, that I'd be interested in that. He said, oh, yeah, okay. Because they know Americans, foreigners, that's what they're interested in. love Istanbul because it's a fascinating city, particularly coming from the United States where, you know, something old is like 50 or 100 years. This is thousands of years. This has been the center of the world, this place. My cab driver took me back to his house. I had tea with his wife. His kids are running around. He rolled a joint of this really good hash. Wow, this is really good stuff. I said, you know, a kilo, 2 kilos. He said, 2 kilos, is that what you want? I said, yeah, 2 kilos. They charged me $150 for each kilo. So I thought, hey, have I pulled this off or what? First night in Istanbul, James Bond has scored. I knew people could get arrested. I knew that sentences were severe in places, but it wasn't going to happen to me. I knew I was way too smart and good-looking to ever get arrested, and I really believed that. I didn't have to act at all in the walking because the cast itself creates the very motion you need to do, and it's heavy and it's awkward because you're clumping and clumping and clumping. I didn't have much acting experience, but I knew if I believe it, they'll believe it. Got to the customs, gave them my passport. Luggage was checked. Like everybody, they look in your bag, but not much. They asked what happened to my leg. I told them that I was walking through some ruins and a bit of crumble on a step, and I fell, and I actually fractured a bone in my leg. And he said, where is your doctor's certificate? A little bit of a heart pounding. Let's stay calm. Let's think this out. I said, I broke it in Izmir.
I don't have one.
Can I go back to Izmir to get one? My plane is leaving now.
I've missed my flight.
Customs people are like, to some degree, like prison guards. They kind of, they can sniff out fear or falsehood. But I didn't look like a smuggler. I was 22 years old and fresh-faced.
I wasn't given one.
I'm not smuggling anything, please. So they passed me through. They changed my seat on the plane so I could have some room to stretch that leg out since it couldn't fit under the seat and so on. Everybody was very sympathetic. The part I was nervous about was Kennedy. What's going to happen when I come back there? I knew that if I got caught in New York with hash, I'd be going to jail. It was fine until I had to make my way out to the door, and as I was walking, I realized I'm leaving a trail because my cast was literally breaking apart. All that clumping had loosened the cast up. I was terrified somebody's going to see this and realize that there's something wrong here, that this is not a real cast. But nobody said a word. So it just confirmed to me how clever I really was. I sold little pieces of this hash to all my friends. I would tape them underneath on my chess set, and I sold the hash like that. This was by far and away the best product around. Everybody wanted some of this stuff. I made close to $5,000, which was an immense amount of money, but the money went quickly. I decided to do it a second time because I was able to do it the first time. October of 69, I went back. Saw my cab driver friend.
Hey, man.
Hey.
Off we went and we essentially did the same thing a second time. What I didn't want to do was put this in a leg cast this time because I just barely pulled that off last time. I'm real skinny. I could tape 4 pounds of hash, which is 2 kilos, 4 pounds. I could tape it all around here and put on a bulky cable net sweater and still look skinny. It was easy for me. 6 months later, the money was gone again. April 1970, my same guy.
Hey!
All the same routine. 2 kilos for about $300. I know I'm going to be able to sell this for thousands of dollars when I get back to the United States. I guess I was a drug smuggler. Sure, I was smuggling drugs. That's what I was. I was a drug smuggler. I mean, I should have had some, I don't know if moral, ethical problems with the consequences of the potential consequences of what this action could mean on my life, and even more so on the lives of the people around me, like my family. But I was way too self-centered and shallow to even think about that. It was just a great way to keep going, making money and keep rolling. Between the time of my third trip and my fourth trip, the PLO hijacked airplanes, flew them into the desert, where they blew up these jets. That was the beginning of this whole new era. That was the beginning of all the airport security that now is just part and parcel of life. In October of 70, when I went back to Istanbul for my fourth trip, I knew that security and airport security certainly is going to be heightened, but my supreme confidence just overrode my intelligence. I had my routine down. I knew the cab driver. This would be another easy score. I went out to the airport, watched people going through customs. Nobody was getting body searched. Nobody was getting frisked. I'm thinking, no problem. Went through customs, they looked at my passport, it's got a lot of stamps in it now. They then had all of the passengers get on a bus. I wasn't quite sure why, because this hadn't happened previous.
I myself have been 2 or 3 weeks in Istanbul, because my son is in the military here.
There was some woman talking to me about her son and traveling here. I was just listening and smiling and thinking, you know, I can't wait to get back to the States.
I have another son who is a lawyer.
And they drove the buses out to where the airplane was. And again, I was thinking it was a little strange, but I didn't quite realize it until I looked out the window of the bus. The airplane had a cordon of soldiers in front of the boarding ramp. And they were, I guess, searching people. This can't be happening. I'm looking at it, but I'm still saying this can't be happening. Not to me. I knew that a month prior, planes had been blown up. And I guess this was the result. Now they're going to search us. I didn't know what to do. I acted like I dropped my passport. I was sort of on the floor thinking, what am I going to do? Well, I would have hidden under the seat and stayed there.
Anything wrong?
The lady said, what do you do? I said, I've lost my passport.
Oh, I can see this.
She said, there, it's in your pocket.
Look.
I said, thanks. I wanted to run. I couldn't get back to the airport with the terminal. I couldn't take all the shit off. I got it all taped to my body. The only way to go was, there's the airplane. If I can just get on that plane. And there was a line of men, and I'm watching this process. When this guy finishes, this man goes and gets on the plane. So all I could do was try and kind of bluff my way through, let me just slide by them. Almost be invisible, just slide by. I got past the first guy, and as I approached the second guy, I had my shoulder bag, and in it was my Frisbee, and I took my Frisbee out of my bag, and I just kind of moved past him as if I'm putting stuff back in the bag. I had my foot in the air. I've told the story and people said, wow, you're being a little dramatic. Not at all. I mean, I had my foot. I was about to step on the plane. This guy looked at me, and I said the other guy had searched me. Now this hand got a little tighter on my shoulder. I'm trying to stay calm, but I was freaked. He hit these hard plaques under my arms. He kept going. And then he hit these hard plaques around my waist. And he kept going. Wow. I guess he didn't really feel it. I'm the least religious of the people, but at that point I'm finding, like, please, Jesus, get me out of this. I will never do this crap again, please. But then he came back up. And when he came back up, then he hit it. Now my heart is really beating, and this guy's looking right at me. I could see in his mind, oh my God, bomb. Again, he's looking for bombs. He's looking for a terrorist. And in his mind, he's got a terrorist. Bomba! He took out his gun, stuck it in my waist, screaming, bomba, bomba, bomba. And all the soldiers put their rifles down, and people started scurrying around, and I'm just frozen there. My whole life was hanging right in that moment. The reality of what was going to happen next was beyond me. He realized, what? That's Esra. That's hash.
Esral,
Turkish word to hash. She said, you know, hash. It's hash. And like, everybody was, oh God, it's just hash. Everybody was so relieved. Except me, of course. It was the changing point in my life. Everything in my life was pre and post that moment at the airport. Everything changed. And it's literally shaped my life from that moment till now. They took me out to Samajalar prison. I had no idea what was going to happen to me. None. I have no idea how long I'm going to be here. I don't know when I'm going to get out of here, if ever. What I wanted to do was just curl up in a little ball somewhere and cry because I was so tired and I was so emotionally drained that I wanted someone to take care of me. In the prison setup, one or two prisoners are assigned to be the heads of that particular cell block. They're in good with the guards, they get treated better, and they sort of run things. He put me in the cell, and there was a bare bunk, and it didn't have blankets and things on it, and it's cold, like steel and stone. There's no heat. I said something to him about, you know, is there a blankets or something, and he said, no, sleep, go to sleep, go to sleep, and clangs the door shut. I could see him fumbling around with a key, but he didn't really lock the door. And then off he went. I heard somebody say, psst, psst. And like, the guy in the next cell was saying something to me, and I wasn't sure what, but my door was open. It's very hard to see. It's night. It's dark. This guy had a stick, and he said, blankets, a couple of cells down. I don't know, but I want a blanket.
Sit.
I wrapped this blanket up around me and soon sort of drifted off a little bit, and the next thing I know... He tried to grab my blanket. Next thing I know, he's pulling, and I'm pulling, and he's pulling. I'm not real big, but I'm real fast and nasty. Somebody's gonna mess with me. I'm gonna mess with them first. Next thing I know, I've hit this guy, and bang, he goes running off. The next thing I know, the doors are opening and guards are coming in. Grab me, start dragging me out. Took me down to the basement. Hamid was there. Hamid was the badass. He's like a bear. He's a big guy. He was a sadist.
Ah! Ah! Please! Please!
It felt like fire each time he hit me. Trying to get away from this thing, and he's whapping me and hitting me. My hands got whapped pretty much because I was trying to stop it like this. I thought they were just killing me. I had a chance to write a letter home to my parents. I didn't know what to say, and I didn't know what to tell them. All I knew was, I have to tell my mother that I'm arrested. Sorry. And I know the pain it's going to cause her. And that was the beginning of, I think that's when I first knew what sorrow was. You know, I've gone through a whole life. My life was so easy until then. But knowing the pain that I'm about to cause my folks, that really brought it home to me of what I've done. But, you know, my dad, when I needed him, as angry as he was and as disappointed as he might have been, he showed up. Within a week or so. It was wonderful to see him, and it was devastating to see him at the same time. To see me locked up like this, it had to be breaking his heart. He said your mother wanted to come, but... said your mother wanted to come, but I didn't think it was a good idea, and it wasn't. I mean, I'm so glad she didn't come. It would have killed her to see me in there. I finally received a 4-year and 2-month prison sentence, and that to me seemed a lifetime away. I was 23 when I was arrested. 4 years in prison, that's a sixth of your life. But there is a question of escape, and that's all people talk about in jail, is escape. Various ways to do it, places to go, how to do it. People had maps, and everybody had stories, and there was the train line that went through Greece and took you over the border, and you could jump off, and that was like, you take the Midnight Express, meaning you take the escape train. You know, you talk about it, but there is a huge abyss of pain and fear between talking about it and trying it, because if you try to escape and you get caught, they don't worry about the American consul. You know, he was escaping, got caught, he got beaten in the escape, or got killed in the escape. Which, you know, is certainly a possibility. But that's really all I thought about for years. The very bottom of the social hierarchy was us, the hash smokers. Rapists, killers, murderers, they're all above us. The very bottom was the drug smugglers, and particularly the foreigner, the hippies. Violence happened a lot. It's long periods of boredom broken up by moments of sheer terror. Seeing the same people, the same faces, the same stories, literally the same clothes, the same colors, you get so bored, and then something would happen. somebody gets stabbed or there'd be this violent confrontation. But I'd been in jail for like a year and a half now. I was desperate to escape from prison. One of the things I'd learned about was a Bakkekoi mental hospital. Under the Turkish law, if you get classified criminally insane, they keep you in this hospital. But I'd heard from all the prison scuttlebutt that it's a much easier place to escape from. That wasn't the hard part. The hard part was once you got out of it, what do you do then? You need someone on the outside. And that's where my friend Patrick was going to be part and parcel of this escape plan. He came and visited me in the prison. We remained stalwart friends throughout. There was nobody listening, so it was pretty easy to talk about the situation.
From what everyone says, it's really easy to escape from.
Patrick would be on the outside with papers, false passport, and a car. I would escape out of Bakkekoi. He'd pick me up, and we'd drive off to the border, and I'd escape.
All I have to do to get in is just convince him I'm crazy. And
which for you should be.
How hard can that be?
None of my friends would have even had a doubt that I could convince them that I was crazy.
Why should I talk to you?
Because I'm here to help you.
No, you're not. You're not here to help me. You're trying to get inside my head, but I'm not going to let you.
I put on a show. I mean, I didn't hold back.
Just tell me what he's writing.
So what are you writing? What are you scribbling down there? Don't write any notes about me.
You should talk to me, will you?
No, I want to talk to him. He's the one with the pen.
Whatever came out.
No, I won't sit down just because you want me to. I'm not going to sit down.
I got to go to Bakkekoi for a period of observation. If prison was bad, Bakkekoi was the bottom of the birdcage. I'd never seen anything like it. Everybody in Bakkekoi was there because they were criminally insane, meaning they had done something hideous.
She got it. 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 She got it.
One weird, emaciated guy was constantly coming up and talking to me.
Cigarette.
He'd say, cigarette, you know? Like, I couldn't get rid of this guy. Every time I turned around, he had these big bug eyes. He was staring at me. He looked like semi-spider.
Cigarette.
There was one old man with this big boil kind of on his head. I never, ever saw him not rubbing this thing. It was raw. It bled. And he kept rubbing it. That's all he did. There was an ex-judge. And he was talking like he was in court. I mean, the man was totally out of his mind. It was a hospital in name only. It was like just a bin for all these broken human beings thrown in here. It really was maddening. Everywhere around you is insanity. In the center of this was a pillar. Everybody marched and dragged their feet around like this wheel of men, this broken spokes going around this wheel. Politically, good Turks walked to the right as opposed to the left. Left is communist. So everybody walked in one direction. The bad part is you're in Bakkekoi. The good part is it's probably easier to escape from there. The walls were old and pitted. You literally could climb over the top. So I was waiting now for the right timing. Patrick was off raising money. He had to get false papers. And so he got himself involved with people who could do that. I got a telegram one day from my dad. Patrick was found dead in his hotel room with a bayonet through his chest. Which, adding to my guilt of the pain I was causing my parents, now my best friend has just died.
She got it.
He got himself involved with people from the underground getting false papers that somehow knew he had money. If I hadn't gotten in jail, if I hadn't done what I've done, Patrick would still be alive. It was probably the lowest point of prison for me. My parents are suffering because of me. Now my friend is dead because of me. It cracked me. But what it also did was, it turned that escape switch off. I got sent back to the Samajalar prison. I realized I still had, whatever it was, another year and a half, 2 years, and I sort of settled into the fact that, okay, I guess I need to spend the rest of the time here. I certainly can't have anybody else die because of me. Enough people have suffered because of me. I need to do this time. And then, the American Consul showed up one day, 54 days before I was scheduled to go free. I was crossing off the calendar, and I thought, oh, he's here early. You know, they've screwed up. I'm going to get out early. As soon as I saw his face, I knew something really bad had happened. I was afraid. I was waiting to hear tragic news about somebody, family. And that's when he said the High Court in Ankara.
Ankara wants to change the verdict. They want you for smuggling, not possession.
At first, I couldn't quite fathom it. Not me. I'm going free.
They're very clear about what they want.
He said they're going to sentence you to life. The only discretion he had was he could lower life to 30 years. But life, 30 years, it's all the same. I can't spend the rest of my life in prison. And that's what essentially was happening. The switch went back on. I needed to get very honed and totally focused on escaping. For me, for Patrick, for my family. One way or the other, whether I escape or whether I get killed trying, I'm getting out of here. Going to the island was incredible news for me. I didn't know how specifically I was going to get off the island, but I knew one way or the other, this is better than the Istanbul prison. It's 17 miles off the coast. The sea is considered to be the wall around the island. You could move around, you could be out in nature. It was heaven compared to the prison. But you're still locked in. Imrali is a work island where boats come from the mainland and bring all this produce, and we work in a canning factory, canning the produce. Boats come into the harbor, and they all have these little dinghies tied behind them. Then they have to leave at night because it's a prison island. But one day, a storm was brewing, and I could see the storm and these clouds, and the waves were starting to whip up. And I realized the boats were anchoring. They were going to spend the night in the harbor because it was getting too rough at sea. And they've all got these little boats tied behind them. Bingo! I knew this is the night. The plan was to be out past the bed check, swim out, cut the rope on one of the dinghies, and to row the dinghy to the mainland. I really had to screw my courage up. As much as I wanted to go, I was scared to death of what was going to happen. This was really leaping off the edge into the abyss here. I'm out past the bed check at night, and if I'm caught, the worst. The scariest part was crawling down across the rocks because I'm exposed out here. It was like a stone pier that went out into the water, and they had guards with guns. If they see me, I'm dead. I got to the edge of the water and went in, and suddenly it's getting a little deeper, and I'm breaststroking my way, trying to be quiet. Trying not to cough, trying not to get a muggy of water in my mouth. I didn't want them hearing me coughing. And kind of collapse in the bottom of this dinghy. I had a knife from the canning factory. I had that in my back pocket. And I was sawing the rope that connected it to the boat like this when I heard a noise. Up above my head, a hatch flapped open. I mean, he was right above me. My heart stopped and I froze there because I'm so open, I'm so vulnerable. If this guy sees me, I'm cooked, I'm done. This fisherman did this big hocking noise and hocked this big loogie out into the ocean. I heard the hatch slam shut again. I waited a half a beat. There was nobody there, and I cut the damn rope. And as soon as I cut the rope, the dinghy started to drift away. I grabbed the oars, about to set them up, and realized they don't have oar locks. They have these, like, wooden pegs. I'd never seen this before. And the boat is drifting, moving back towards the rocks and the shore and the guards, and I'm struggling to try and get this thing in, and the oar missed, and the other oar missed. But I finally managed to figure it out, and once I got it a little bit of traction, I realized how to do it, and I started to move against the current. What I needed to do was get into the open sea past the last of the boats, and I was so concentrating on rowing and not missing a stroke, I almost wasn't aware. I looked up and realized that I'm past the end of the island. Wow. I'm past the last of the boat. I'm free. For the first time in like 5 years, I'm beyond the bounds. There's nobody telling me what to do. It was an incredible feeling. The problem became that once I got beyond the island, I really was kind of disoriented. It was 17 miles to the mainland. I'm screwed. I'm gonna get swept way out to sea. I was frightened and I was cold and I was vulnerable. But what I realized was, if I die, I'm free. If I escape, I'm free. If I die, I'm free. And that was a very liberating feeling. One way or the other, I'm out of prison. That feeling alone suffused me. All my muscles and all my body was just livened by the feeling that I'm out, and I did it. I'd have rowed forever. I'd rowed 100 miles. I'm gonna row until I die or till I hit the damn beach. I was chanting to myself, if they catch me, they'll beat me. If I make it, I'm free. Catch me, you know, that kind of stuff. Whatever kept me going, I was rowing and rowing, and I rowed and rowed.
Catch me, they'll beat me. Make it, I'm free. Catch me, they'll beat me. Make it, I'm free. Catch me, they'll beat me. Make it, I'm free. Catch me, they'll beat me. Make it, I'm free.
Suddenly, I lifted up a little bit, and the boat scraped. And it was sand. And then the wave lifted up a little bit again, and I was there. It was the sand. I was like on the beach. It truly was the finest morning of my whole life. Ecstatic at being out here in the morning with the sun coming up and the sky over me. But I know that now there's going to be a bed check, And somewhere they're gonna start counting and they'll realize, where is William? I'm still in the middle of Turkey. The clock is ticking. They're looking for me. And if they find me now, I'm dead. The plan was to get to the Greek border. There's a river that separates Greece and Turkey. And I know if I swim across the river, on the other side is Greece. The Greeks and the Turks have been enemies for thousands of years, mortal enemies. There was no way the Greeks are going to send me back to Turkey unless I killed someone. I saw Turkish border guards patrolling this open section. I know somewhere just up ahead is real freedom, which is what Greece was for me. When the sun set, I started making my way out across this rocky field. I kind of dropped down into this irrigation ditch. I started to come up over the top of the ditch and I heard footsteps. I couldn't quite make out where it was, but it was getting closer. It was two Turkish border guards walking along the top of the ridge that I was about to be going over. And I froze. I was curled up on the bottom thinking stone, inanimate object. And I'm getting freaked now. It's like that was really close. At one point I heard dogs, and that freaked me out. For some reason, I took off my shoes and socks, these old beat-up sneakers and socks, thinking if they're following my scent, these dogs would come and they'd smell these sneakers and it would blow their noses out and they wouldn't be able to follow me anymore. It seemed like a good idea at the time. It was a terrible idea because now I'm barefoot and I could feel my feet getting chopped up and there were twigs and rocks. As I moved through these trees, I could hear. I could hear water. I could hear the river. Somewhere up ahead, I was desperate to get to that river. I came through trees and there was the water in front of me. And it was like, that's it. I was so close, nothing was going to stop me. My fear now was, I know there are Turkish soldiers here, I know there have to be Greek soldiers over there, and whether it's a Greek bullet or a Turkish bullet, either way, I'm dead. All I wanted to do was make my way across, and the river washed me down. I swam and swam and swam until I hit some mud, and I came and I was on this muddy riverbank. But the reality was, I'm still not really sure that I'm free. I'm still not really sure this is Greece. What I didn't want to do is run up to the first person and say, hey, here I am, and have him turn out to be a Turkish soldier. I was so spaced out from being up and running and moving for so many days. I was having these visual hallucinations, these audio hallucinations. I couldn't trust my senses. My mind was like inflamed. At one point, I came up upon what was like a dusty road. I didn't even see it, but passed what was like a wooden kiosk. What it was a sentry booth, and as I passed it, suddenly this bayonet came down. He was more freaked out than I was. He said something to me. And I realized I didn't understand him. And he said something else, and I realized I don't understand him. I speak good Turkish. He's not talking Turkish. It must be Greek. It was like, yes. I collapsed on the ground with my arms in the air. More soldiers came up and running, and I'm on the ground laughing like a loon. I knew at that point, I made it. I landed at JFK. There was my dad, his hair all silver, and, he was ecstatic to see me, as I was to see him. There's a photo of me and my dad sitting there, and I was like hanging on to him. Once again, I'm a little boy, and my father's taking care of me.
Still feel guilty about it?
Oh, terribly guilty. Terribly guilty. You know, my dad's been dead 3 years now, and I still feel guilty. Once I got out, everything changed, that I was a happy guy, and I was on top of the world, and... You know, I've got a book, and I've got a movie, and I made money, and... I met my wife, and I had a wonderful life, and all that good stuff. But deep down, I still feel somehow I had to make it up to him of what I put him through. Looking back now, I can talk about it being experience in life, and I learned so much, and I did. But the cost to my family. That's hard.
Thank you for listening to Locked Up Abroad. You don't want to miss a single episode, so subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, the Wondery app on Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You'll find a link to subscribe on the episode notes. Simply tap or swipe over the cover art. You'll also see some great offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting our sponsors. If you have a moment, I'd love for you to complete a small survey at wondery.com/survey. Give us your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to tell all your friends about our show. Locked Up Abroad was produced by Raw TV Limited for National Geographic Channels. For our audio adaptation, the editor is Sergio Enriquez. Our producer is Donna Himes. Our executive producers are Jeffrey Glazer and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.